We are the voice of Southwest Virginians. It is time for another episode of Farm Talk, the show that is dedicated to answering your questions about all things agricultural. And we have with us Phil Blevins, Washington County Agricultural Extension Agent.
All right. Thank you, Ivy. It's good to be back with everyone today. I wanted to make one announcement before we get started. Those of you that are gardeners and have an interest in gardening, our Master Gardener group will be doing the Garden Fair. That'll be next weekend, Friday and Saturday of April on the, I suppose that would be the 19th and 20th. Does that sound right? Okay, so, we'd encourage you to come out and see what's going on there. That's usually a good event for those that are gardening, everything from garden tools to plants and lots of educational programs going on. So if you're interested in that, then we'd encourage you to be out for that. I thought we'd turn our attention today since it's warm outside today and it's rained and the grass is green and growing. It's not going to be long till we think about hay time for farmers. And so I thought we'd talk a little bit about that today and see how far we get with that. We think about hay. That's one of the things that's critical to the livestock industry around here. Obviously, we graze during the summer on pastures and try to take as much advantage of that as we can, but in the depth of winter, we had to feed hay. And so that's an important part of agriculture here. And just to give those of you that might be farming that are listening out there, we actually do a variety test at the research station for orchard grass and fescue to try to determine what are some of the better varieties. And if you have an interest in that data or that information, if you get in touch with me, I'd be glad to provide it to you. There's lots of good orchard grass and fescue varieties out there and really high yielding. And we've started a new one in 2020. We seeded actually in 2020 in the fall. We seeded the last one. We're getting ready to seed the next one. But over a three-year period, we had varieties that yielded 23 tons or more per acre. And so that's a good bit of feed and a good bit of high-quality feed. On the fescue side, one of the things that we try to figure out and try to test are some of the varieties that don't have the endophyte toxicity problem that Kentucky 31 fescue does. And so there's some really good what are called novel endophyte varieties out there. The endophyte that you find in a fescue produces ergovaline, the one that's in Kentucky 31, which is which is not good. I mean, it causes stress on the animal, actually reduced weight gains because it is a toxin, and that endophyte actually is beneficial to the grass because it makes it tougher, it makes it more pest resistant, more drought tolerant, and some things like that. But the positive endophyte that we find in Kentucky 31 causes problems. If you get in some parts of the country where it's a little warmer, maybe the Piedmont region, you'll see occasionally cattle in the wintertime that'll lose the tip of their tail, sometimes lose one of their feet. It's called fescue foot. And what happens is this ergovaline actually restricts the circulation of the blood in the extremities. If you've ever heard of ergot poisoning that happens in humans, that's actually a similar type poisoning that takes place where these ergot bodies are found in rye. And people that ate rye bread, these ergot bodies would get mixed up in the flour, and it would cause various things to happen, like hallucinations and sensations in the extremities. And some believe that's actually part of what was happening in the Salem witch trials, was ergot poisoning. And some parts of the world, when you'll see people that still consume this, and they have problems with gangrene in the extremities of their hands and feet. And so it's the same kind of thing. But what was discovered a few years ago are there are what are called novel endophytes that actually give the fescue its persistence and toughness, etc., but they aren't toxic to animals. And so there's several novel endophyte varieties out there, and we try to test some of those. And people don't think about this, but hay fields should be periodically reestablished. Just because it's, Ivy was mentioned, just because it's green and growing a while ago doesn't mean it's good. And so sometimes we need to reestablish. And so getting a good variety is a good idea. But Let's talk about what high-quality hay is. And one of the indicators, if I were to ask you if we could poll the audience, you would say hay that's green, and that's correct, because green color is an indication of quality, but also you want something that has a lot of leaves, a high leaf-to-stem ratio, and that's really affected by how mature the crop is when we harvest it and how we harvest it. And then we want one free of weeds and one that's free of mold. And that's really what high quality hay is. And so the ultimate test, though, of what quality hay is animal performance. And there are three things in hay that influence how well animals do on it. And basically that is, are they gaining weight, or if they're cows, are they milking well? One of those is, will they eat it? You know, if you won't eat it, it don't matter. And hay has to be palatable if it's to be consumed in adequate qualities. It's got to taste good to the animal. Then it has to really be digestible and have sufficient nutrient content in it. Once the hay is eaten, it has to be digested to be converted to animal products. And one of the amazing things about the cow and the sheep and the horse to some extent, but the cow and the sheep in particular, they are ruminants. And so they can actually take grass and these forage plants that you and I can't consume and live on. And because they're ruminants, they can turn those into a product that we can use, whether that be meat or milk or wool or whatever it might be. And so, but at the same time, we want it to be high quality. And then you don't want any toxic factors in it. I mean, you don't want poison weeds or poison plants in it, or a lot of mold for that matter. And so, you know, if we think about trying to be successful with a hay crop, if you think about the fact that 30 to 40% of all costs are fixed costs, you know, you have the equipment, you have the land, you have these things that are going to be cost the same regardless of whether you have high yield or low yield. And so we want those, we want to do our very best to have maximum yield, but we want it at acceptable quality. And so there's a trade-off there. And as I said, level of animal performance has got to be the focus. And we think about the two nutrients that we're most concerned with in forage is crude protein content and energy are the two most important things we're thinking about in the beef cow ration, sheep, et cetera, because those are the big two. And so in Southwest Virginia, and this really this whole region here, generally, the biggest problem we have is low digestible energy. So you see people that get focused on protein, and occasionally we do need to add some protein to the diet. But the big deal is low energy, because as we have a hard time getting hay up on time sometimes, and so we have hay that's been weather damaged or it's over mature or whatever the case might be that's caused it to be lower quality, and the energy value goes down. And so that's something that's got to be focused on. And really, the only way you can know that with the hay crop is to do a forage analysis on it. And so, you know, the things that affect quality after we get the hay established are obviously fertility. That's always going to be a big deal. You know, protein, one of the components of protein is nitrogen. So it needs adequate nitrogen. It also needs some sulfur, which, by the way, when we think about that, sulfur was not an issue in our soils, because if you went to the west of this, of the East Coast, if you went to the west, there were a significant number of industries that were coal-fired. The power plants were coal-fired, and the exhaust from those wasn't necessarily clean. And so we got enough deposition out of rainfall of sulfur that we never were sulfur deficient. I remember when I first came here as an extension agent, there was a lot of talk about the Smokies, about acid rain and what it was doing to the fir trees in the Smokies. Well, that's not a problem anymore. I mean, we've cleaned up these coal plants and these industries that use coal. They were scrubbers on the smokestacks and things like that, till now we are actually in a sulfur deficient area. And so I guess that's on the plus column as far as cleaning up the air, but it's on the minus column as far as sulfur content in the soil. So we have to add some of that now. So fertilization is a big deal. And then the stage of maturity. And that's probably the single most important thing that the producer can control is, when do I cut the hay? And then harvest procedures. You know, there's things that we can do in the harvest process that will either enhance or degrade the quality of the product that we have, the hay that we're harvesting. And so that stage of maturity, though, is a big deal because it influences a lot of things. It influences palatability. Is, you know, how is it going to taste to the cow or the sheep or whatever it is, or the horse? What's going to be the crude protein content and the energy? Those things are all influenced by the stage of harvest. And so what we have to do is we have to get a trade-off. Obviously, maximum yield, we're going to let it go a little longer than we wanted it to for a quality standpoint if we wanted maximum yield. But if we wanted maximum quality, we would be mowing the grass. We'd be making hay when it was about 6 or 7 inches tall. And obviously, that's not realistic either. And so there's a point where you kind of get the best combination of the two, yield and quality. And with legumes like alfalfa, which is called the queen of forages, that's in the bud to early bloom stage. Now with grasses, it's in what's called the boot to early head stage. And those are when we get the best combination of yield and quality. And, you know, if you're an alfalfa grower, you know what the bud looks like and you know what the flowers look like. They have those pretty purple flowers in them. So we don't want too many flowers in the field when we cut it. 10% maybe is the maximum that we'd be thinking about on most cuttings. You know, we might go a little longer than that on the first cutting. But with the grasses, which is most of what we make in this part of the world, is grass hay, you're really looking at just about the time the head comes out of the shoot. And so if you know what an orchard grass seed head or a fescue seed head looks like, you don't want it in full flower. You don't want the heads fully emerged if you can possibly do that. Now, I understand. I understand the difficulty because a lot of times when the grass is at the right stage, it's either too cool to cure it or it's raining every day. And so, you know, I'm talking about what's ideal. And so you may say, well, it's hard to do what you're saying. And I understand that completely. And sometimes it's a matter of timing. But those grasses, obviously we want to get them at the boot or early head stage. Like I said, even if you're making wheat, a small grain hay like wheat or rye, same thing applies in those cases. And once you get past these ideal stages, quality goes down rapidly because what happens then is indigestible portions of the plant begin to increase. There's a factor, for those of you that don't know the jargon that we're talking about, there's a measurement in hay, it's called neutral detergent fiber. And when that level gets above 65%, then intake really goes down on the animal. And because these plants are a lot of fiber, there's a lot of fiber in them, but we want as much of that fiber to be digestible as possible. And the older the plant gets after the stages that I'm talking about, then the amount of lignin, or we might say woody type tissue, increases. Unless you're feeding termites, that's not going to be very prosperous. And so the further we get past the optimum stage of forage, the poorer the animal performance will be. And this poor quality hay passes really slow through the animal and lowers the intake of the animal. Those of you that have cattle know this time of the year when they're grazing this really tender green grass that you better not stand behind the cow because it's really passing through them quickly and becomes their manure becomes really runny. In the wintertime, if we're feeding a poor quality hay, then it really gets hard, kind of like a horse. And so we want something in between that when we're feeding hay. And so those growth stages that I talked about help us get that accomplished. There was actually, if you think about this, there's a study done at the University of Tennessee by one of my old professors, Dr. Monty Montgomery, several years ago on Holstein heifers. And they were what they were looking at was the effect of stage of harvest of fescue hay on the quality of the hay and the animal gain, or how many pounds a day they were gaining on these Holstein heifers. And when they cut it in the late boot to head stage, this would have been about May the 3rd. I'm not sure what part of Tennessee this was done in, but that would be pretty close to when we would see that in this part of the world, maybe a week earlier. The dry matter intake of these animals was 13 pounds a day. And they also did a cutting of early bloom, which would have been about 2 weeks later or 11 days later on May the 14th. And then they did one in what would be called the early milk stage, or when the seed was forming, on May the 25th, or another 11 days later. And so what happened is dry matter intake went from 13 pounds per day on these animals down to 8.6 pounds per day on, unfortunately, when we usually make our first cutting of hay. And so that demonstrates how important that is.
And Phil, you mentioned a garden fair that's happening next weekend, April 19th and 20th.
Yes, that's our Extension Master Gardeners. It's one of the programs in our Extension offices, the Master Gardener Volunteer Program. And they've been doing this garden fair now as an educational event since about 1998, I guess, when the Master Gardeners got started in our office in Washington County. It always takes place at the Higher Ed Center at Exit 14 in Abingdon, and it's really the people that go, I think, are well pleased with what they get to see there, because it's largely a big trade show is what it amounts to, with a lot of vendors there for people to talk to. But there are classes every day on various horticultural topics, and so it's really a nice event that they do. I can't take, even though it's a program in the and it's in my bailiwick in the Extension office, I can't take credit for it, because the volunteers do all the work and they really do a nice job.
So that is April 19th and 20th at the Higher Ed Center in Abingdon, the Garden Fair, and a great event. And we'll get back to the talking about pastures, and I have a couple questions for you. So growing up, both my brother and my father were agronomy majors and studied pasture science, and they were always really proud that we didn't have any Johnson grass or other kind of invasive things in the pasture. And I know that's important in keeping Jimson weed out and the olives that come up here, the invasive species. How do folks deal with that?
Okay, well, let's look at it from two angles. In pasture, you rarely find Johnson grass in pasture because the cattle really like it. Johnson grass was brought to this part of the world by General Johnson. I don't remember the first name, I think. It was brought into the South as a forage grass, and it's become a pest in cropland because of its aggressive nature, and its rhizome system underground has made it a problem in row crop fields. In a hay field, it can be a problem. It's not a bad quality feed. I'm certainly not encouraging anybody to grow Johnson grass, because it's a warm season grass and probably not as productive in some cases as some of our cool season grasses, depending on how we manage it. But in a hay field, it can be problematic if you don't want it. There are some things that people can do to try to control that. One of those would be to use glyphosate with a wick applicator, where you actually, the Johnson grass will get taller than what you want, and you can actually wick glyphosate on it or rub it on it and kill it. Now, in alfalfa, it's reasonably easy to control because there's herbicides that'll take it out. The other invasives that you talk about, like autumn olive, multiflora rose, and then some of those annual weeds like Jimson weed, cocklebur, and some of those, you can actually control those if you're diligent about it. There's lots of good products out there that are relatively easy to use. They're safe for the environment. And if we get the timing right on those annual weeds like Jimson weed, cocklebur, spiny pigweed, if we treat early in the summer, then we can take care of those. The unfortunate thing is a lot of people are busy, or they don't notice them until it's late in the summer, and then they're tough and they're hard to control. Those woody plants like autumn olive and multiflora rose, or Callery pear or Bradford pear that we're beginning to have a lot of trouble with, those are best controlled about the time they bud. And so it won't be long till we'll be at that stage to where the multiflora rose is about getting ready to bloom, and autumn olive has the leaves have hardened up a little bit, and we can actually control those things pretty easily with some products like Remedy or MSM, lots of things. Anybody that wants to know what they need to use and how much and so forth, you can give me a call. You know, I won't try to ad lib the rates online, but there are ways we can get rid of those things. But it is important to control them, because they take away from the desirable plants that we want growing.
Yeah, well, the other question I have, and if it's too far off topic, let me know, is with the kind of move of folks wanting to go back to grass-fed beef, how does that affect the way that you, what you want to grow in your pasture and what you're looking for?
Well, it makes a big difference. It really does, because if you're grazing, obviously, with grass-fed beef, you're grazing most of the time, and so you have to have something that's high quality enough when you get to the point where the cattle are beginning to finish. So let's say we've got a steer that he should have a half inch of back fat on him when he weighs 1,200 pounds. So when he starts, you know, getting around 1,000 pounds or so, somewhere in that neighborhood, not necessarily exactly 1,000, then we need him on something that's high quality enough that he's gaining fast enough that he's putting fat down, and that he's actually putting marbling in the muscle. And so that does impact greatly what you have. Kentucky 31 Fescue would not be the choice in that case, because especially if that's in the summertime, he is going to slow down to where he's not gaining hardly anything. And so it depends on how people approach it. They can graze summer annuals, some of those things like dwarf pearl millet, some of the Sedan or sorghum type plants that are high quality, the brown midrib ones that have less lignin in them. Alfalfa is one. I remember early on in my extension career that there was a project done at Virginia Tech with Dr. Gerken where he grazed steers on alfalfa, a load of steers, and they actually killed those at Valleydale, was still in business, to see how they graded out. And so it really has to be high quality if you're going to carry them all the way through on grass. And it'll also make a difference, obviously, in the bottom line, because you don't want an old animal. You don't want to just keep them around until they live long enough that they get fat. You really want to process them when they're less than 2 years old. So that's a great question regarding that. All right. So we were talking about the effective stage of harvest on quality and animal gain. And I mentioned this test, it was this research project that was done in Tennessee where they harvested three times, May 3rd, May 14th, May 25th, at three different growth stages of tall fescue, and how intake went down. Well, intake's important. You know, if intake goes from 13 pounds a day down to 8.5 pounds a day, that really affects gain. And I'll tell you what that was in a minute. But what happened also at the same time is digestibility went down. The percent of the plant that was digestible of what these animals were eating went from 68% on May the 3rd to 56% on May the 25th. So, you know, that's 13 percentage points that it went down. The percent protein went from 13.8% on May the 3rd to 7.6% on May the 25th. So that's almost half in terms of the of the protein percent that it decreased. So what happened, you know, yield went up, which we would expect because the plant's getting bigger. But what happened to pounds of gain per day on these animals? On the early, the boot stage grass, the animals were gaining 1.39 or almost a pound and a half a day. On the grass that was at the milk stage or the seed forming stage, the gain was less than half a pound a day. And so it is important, this growth stage and when we do it. Same thing applies to alfalfa. You know, if you mention alfalfa to a lot of people, well, alfalfa's high quality. Well, yeah, it is high quality if you cut it at the right stage. You know, good quality alfalfa is going to be somewhere around 18-20% protein. And the energy value is really going to be high on that too. But if you compare that to poor quality alfalfa, for example, alfalfa that was too mature or that wasn't managed right in the harvest and most of the leaves are gone and all you got stems, if you compare those two, good versus poor, then the gain per day on a study that was also done at the University of Tennessee, the gain went from almost 2 pounds a day down to where they were losing weight. And so you can't overemphasize the importance of quality. And so we have to do the very best we can to try to get that done. So how often should you harvest? We'll continue this discussion next week because there's a lot of other things we're going to talk about. But this will probably wind us up today. So how often should you harvest grasses and legumes? You know, with orchard grass and fescue in this part of the world, we usually make two cuttings, but we could probably do better than that. if we cut on time as far as growth stage goes, we can harvest again in about 4 to 6 weeks on these plants. We go much longer than that. We start, the older leaves start to senesce and become low quality. So about every 4 to 6 weeks is when we could think about it if we have good fertility, good growing conditions. With red clover, we're talking about early bloom. There was a kind of a thought, it's interesting, or a thought that was around here for years, is you let clover go till the leaves turn brown before you harvest it. Well, that's okay if you're trying to reseed the ground with red clover, because it's made seed by then and you're going to shatter all those seed back on the ground. But that's really going to be really, really low quality feed. And then with small grains, I mentioned earlier, like rye, barley, or wheat, we're talking about in the boot to early head stage for hay. Now, if you're making balage or if you're making silage, you're probably going to let some of that go to the dough stage, particularly with barley, to get maximum yield and maximum quality in that case. And sometimes with barley at the dough stage, it can rival corn silage in terms of feeding value. So we'll continue this discussion next week. I like talking about this. I hope you learned something from it. And we'll keep it going next week. Ivy, I appreciate you having me on today.
Well, thank you so much, Phil. This show is just a wealth of knowledge and I think a wonderful opportunity for listeners in the area to get some questions answered and maybe learn a thing or two. Be sure to tune in to the next episode of Farm Talk with Phil Blevins, Wednesday at 1 o'clock. And get in your questions. Email them at pblevins@vt.edu or give us a call here at WEHC 276-944-6933. This is WEHC Emory and WISE FM Wise.